Meditieren, Yoga, Joggen, nichts entspannt mich.
Echt? Mich entspannt meine Steuer total.
Steuer? Wie Finanzamt? Die Steuererklärung?
Ja, ich habe ganz locker über 1000 Euro zurückbekommen.
Hast du geheime Connections oder Excel-Superkräfte?
Nö, nur die Wieso-Steuer-App.
Wow, und das ist einfach?
Klar, die macht fast alles automatisch.
Ich fühle mich plötzlich so entspannt.
Hol dir dein Geld zurück. Abgabefrist 31. Juli.
Was?
Schaffst du ganz entspannt mit Wieso-Steuer.
Ach, ja.
Welcome to Mysterious Universe, Season 34, Episode 14. Coming up on the show, we've got the Makara and the Naga King, Insanity in the Mist, and the Redemption of the Rainmakers. I'm your host, Benjamin Grundy. Joining me is Aaron Wright.
I'm sorry. Do we have any antihistamines?
What's wrong with your face? Why is it all scrunched up and red?
The second!
Yeah, I like watching the clips of us doing this show, and every 3 seconds I'm like scratching my face or rubbing my nose.
What the hell is going on in this place? What a great way to start the show.
When was the last time you vacuumed?
I vacuumed the other day.
Yeah, the other day a year ago.
The air conditioning, this freaking spider webs up there.
In 2024, you vacuumed.
I
swear,
place.
I have to go into your office and just pick up all these little bits of paper that are on the floor that have been
BS.
There for 7 months.
That is absolute
like,
BS.
Aaron will shred a document and all of it will just sprinkle on the floor. You can come back 7 weeks later. It'll still be there. And he's like, why is it so dusty in here? Why am I getting allergies in my room?
Oh,
it's because you're living in filth.
The whole office is filth. Can I just burn it down? That's my plan. I just want to burn this entire office down, walk away from Mysterious Universe.
2 months. You just got to make it. 2 months.
2 months.
We'll let the new hosts burn it down.
Okay, that works. We've found new hosts.
We have.
We're not going to give details yet.
Announcement coming soon.
Yes.
Thank you to everyone who applied, yes. By the way. And I'm going to send out some emails to those who made the shortlist, which I haven't done yet. Thank you for forcing that now.
Oh, I do apologize.
But, yeah, but we do have a selection. And it's two Americans. We ended up going with a guy in Texas and California, two friends who know each other, experienced podcasters. And really, we went with people who had, I guess, the most knowledge and love for the topics.
Yeah. Well, it wasn't even about that because we got some really excellent candidates. Like, I was really quite surprised, to be honest.
It took a while.
Well, it took a while, but we got really, really great candidates. But the problem was a lot of them were by themselves, so that made things a little bit more difficult. And then trying to work out who we could pair up wasn't really going to necessarily work. And then it came down to some people that – the thing is, these guys, they know Mysterious Universe. They've been with us for a long time. They know our understandings, our concepts, the themes that we do. And just listening to them and talking to them, they've brought what I think something is certainly in me has been lacking for a while is an enthusiasm for this particular topic, like an incredible renewal of enthusiasm.
And they have a love for the topics, but they're not green. They're not coming at these topics as in, ghosts, what are they?
Have you heard of Roswell?
Yeah, exactly. There's a bit of maturity there.
Not that other candidates were like that. I mean, we really did have exceptional people and it made it quite difficult to decide, you know, who we're going to go with. But not only that, these guys, you know, they've worked together for a long time. So that dynamic is there as well. So yeah, we're pretty excited for what's coming.
Yeah. So if this is news to you, Aaron and I are retiring from the show in December this year. Hopefully we can get the new guys in December and just have this seamless transition. And then Aaron and I are working on a new show. The working title is Brunch with the Boys.
Which obviously people thought we were being serious. I mean, we're obviously not doing that, but we will come up. It is going to be a show. I won't give too many details away, but it is going to be more about like what's happening at the moment.
Well,
like,
I wanted to call it domestic terrorism with the boys, but you don't seem to be into that.
Again, because we're in Australia, someone's going to kick our door in and arrest us before we know it if we
say
something wrong.
The Fraternal Brotherhood of the Sun was another one, which Aaron also turned down.
Yeah, that's probably not a good idea. Let's just stick.
It'll be some
kind
of brotherhood, some kind of exclusive club, men only. It'll be very right wing.
No, it won't be.
We'll be dressed in full uniform, armbands.
Sometimes.
No, we don't know yet. The truth is we don't. Coming up with a name for a podcast
is the hardest thing.
Impossible in 2025. Yeah. Like when we first started 20 years ago, easy.
Yeah.
There was like 200 podcasts in the world.
Go for it.
That's it.
Yep. But no,
there was no names. Now You can't, you list anything, you search for any name, there's
gone
10 of them already in the directories.
It's not just that though. When we started, it's like there wasn't even any social media. I think Facebook was just starting. So it's like, if you come up with a name, you're like, hey, cool, we've actually got a name that's not a podcast, but then it's like, it's a TikTok channel or it's Instagram. It's just like, it's all right, we'll come up with something. It doesn't matter. But actually,
well, the important thing to say is we're not going anywhere. We're not retiring from podcasting. All new show coming. We're really excited about it. And we also,
that's what used to
be. There's going
to
be a big change because we're changing studios and we're also not sure who of us is going to be in the country and who of us is going to remain.
Well, I'm thinking of certainly leaving the coast and I'm trying to work out what I do because it is a big deal to go. There's not many places that I can necessarily go. So I do have access to a couple of places. So I may be going there, but we'll see.
Bunker in New Zealand?
No, not a bunker. I wouldn't go to New Zealand. They're even worse with their laws. Like, it's just, but I am thinking about going. I'm definitely leaving the coast. So I might be going back to Sydney. We'll just see what happens. But you and I will be recording remotely, but we'll work it out.
We need to find a country where domestic terrorism with the boys is an acceptable name for a podcast.
Well, that would be the United States. That actually would be the United States.
Really?
Yes, because I've got the First Amendment. So you could call it whatever the hell you want.
I'm pretty sure you still wouldn't be able to call it domestic terrorism with the boys.
It's satire. Come on. It's satire.
Yeah, and we just plan it out on the show. Like every episode is planning the attack.
No, we just like provide examples of like Soros funding, you know, protests or something. Like, that's what it's about. So we're not doing the domestic terrorism.
That's a good idea.
We're just talking about other people doing
anyway,
it.
Anyway, back to Mysterious Universe. I'm going to be talking about...
Fucking vacuum cleaner now!
No one can hear it, man.
I'm a mess.
Chill.
Mess.
Chill. Coming up, I'm going to be talking about Bibu's latest, The Dragon and the Serpent. Rain spirits and the enigmatic Makara Naga symbolism.
Oh, the Nagas. Aren't they those weird lights that seemingly are supposed to come up out of the water basin or something that people claim? Have you seen like the Naga lights?
What are you talking
the
about?
The Naga lights. They're like serpentine lights that come up, and I don't know exactly what part of Asia it's from, but they come up out of the water and people say that they witness like these strange old style dragons that are associated with these lights, like coming up. It's really weird.
Talking like the Marfa lights, Will-o-the-Wisp style activity. I'm talking about, a Naga is a serpent entity.
Right.
A Naga is a serpent being.
Let me look
They traditionally protect treasure. They're you know, guardians of the underworld.
They're the Naga fireballs, also known as the Mekong lights. They're ghost lights. Yeah, you're right. So it's like Min Min lights. They're a phenomenon that's seen annually on the Mekong River. But there are some stories that it's attached to dragon-like entities. So that's...
Yeah, because that's what a Naga is.
Right. Oh, there you go.
Thanks for derailing.
Yeah, totally derailed it.
Everything.
That's right.
Do you want to talk about the vacuum again?
Can you hear it? It's a precedent. It's someone whinging about the vacuum cleaner on the show. What a strange thing for me to do.
To be fair, it was 100 times more annoying when I was ranting about it.
Because it's not the same guy. I think after your rant, he probably got the sack. Because you don't hear the...
Yeah, it's like a little old lady now. They got rid of the guy. The low IQ, 69 IQ guys with the... vacuuming into the wall over and over again. Like an AI gone wrong. Now they got like a smart little lady doing it.
Yeah, much more quiet. It's kind of quiet. I heard a couple of bangs. That's what set me off.
Yeah, so I'm going to be talking about this connection to, he starts off with rain dances, but also talks about these connections across cultures around the world where they all worshipped a kind of deity that was responsible for rain, storms, floods. And there was an idea that you had to appease this entity. You had to perform a sacrifice or a ritual so that you would receive rain, enough rain for the crops and for the harvest.
It's not that dissimilar to that story that I was telling you years ago about the rainstone. Remember how there was like rumors of there being a rainstone around here somewhere? Mm. It's the same thing. It had to be treated with reverence and respect. And if you didn't, if you moved it, if you upset it, it would cause these, you know, torrential downpours to come through.
Well, this stuff is still practiced today, and I'm going to give you some examples in a moment. But one of the ones that I liked was from 2022 when they had the MotoGP race, you know, the bikes.
Yeah.
They had the MotoGP race in Indonesia and it was just raining all weekend, like torrential downpour.
What is it, Queensland?
But yeah, exactly. Yeah. They had the scheduled time for the race arrive and it was still raining. So they brought in this shaman.
Forgive my ignorance with MotoGP. Are you still allowed to race when it's raining? Or you can't?
You can race when there's a little bit of water, but when there's too much water on the track, it's too dangerous to race. So they had to stop the race, and it was delayed. So they bring this lady out, and she starts doing her, well, the reversal of a rain dance. It's a rain stopping ceremony.
Is it a prayer bell and some?
Yeah, she was going up and down the track, and by the end of it, there she was, finishing her ritual, and it had stopped raining.
That's awesome. And see the offering she's got there?
Yeah.
It's like she's got fruits and what is that, flowers or something?
Yeah,
and,
she became
an incense.
Really popular, and they turned her into a meme. So now she's rah-rah the rain shaman. But this is still practiced today, and Bibu ties this all together with some intriguing links across cultures as to what the Nagas are and why so many cultures connect the bringing of rain and storm and floods, connections to the harvest, why they all attribute it to the serpent. And we'll extend this to Quetzalcoatl and the civilization bringing serpent gods as well. It's really fascinating. I can't wait to talk about it.
All right. I'm looking forward to getting into it. After our discussion last week, actually, about the remote viewing and that river of time, I received a DM from someone I've been chatting with on and off over the years. More often, she contacts me. Thanks, Llewellyn. Her name's Llewellyn. And she contacts me to correct me about my pronunciations of British place names. So she seems to be rather, but that's not the issue, so I'm not giving her a hard time about that. But she's told me a couple of strange stories over the years, and you take everything with a grain of salt, especially when you just get, you know, a singular name contacting you. But she said after the experience, or after we had our kind of in-depth discussion about the nature of reality and time, and we're describing that river, she's like, I've seen it.
Seen the river.
She's like, I have seen that river.
Was she the one you were describing who saw the petal, the pebbles?
No. She's like, I've hadn't spoken to her about anything like that at all. She just, because she heard the show, and she's like, I've seen it. It's in the Cotswolds. I'm like, what?
It's a real physical place just down the road to the left.
Yeah. And I was like, what the hell? So yeah, I asked if I can retell this story. So yes, I've been given permission to do so. So I've tied it in actually. With a couple of other experiences that suggest that, well, maybe there is a little something more to this than just simply a story. So we'll go into that later on at the end of the show.
Yeah, awesome. Okay, well, let's get into Bibu. Bibu Dev Misra, of course, one of the writers on our site and one of my favorites. He always does these incredible...
He's really good.
Well, he does these deep dives into ancient history, and he comes at it often from ancient Indian history, but he ties in all these connections. So obviously in our past, like I said, cultures all around the world, they looked at nature as something sentient.
Yeah, of course, like animism.
Exactly. Nature wasn't mechanistic. The forces of nature were controlled by spirits, by deities. And you needed to acknowledge these entities. You needed to give them penance, sacrifice, whatever, so appease them so that you would receive benevolent forces from them. And the most prevalent was the rain-giving spirits, because obviously without rainfall, you don't get fed. Your crops don't grow. So now the modern mind believes this is superstition. We look at this as old-fashioned thinking. This is something backwards, and we don't partake in it in any way today. But if you look at some cultures, like I just gave the example from the MotoGP Indonesian shaman, some people around the world still believe in this, they still practice it. And this is where
evidently it works.
Yeah, this is where Bibu gets us into this research he's been doing. He looks at a Kenyan academic. His name's Mokua Umbati. And he wrote this paper, it was a few years ago now, but it was entitled Rainmaking Rituals, Song and Dance for Climate Change in the Making of Livelihoods in Africa. And I looked at his other publications, and it's all just like, where's my screen cap? It's all just like breaking the barrier of feminism and indigenous cultural resources for Marxist this and Marxist that, this and gender that.
Yeah.
So it's pretty clear what his ideology is. But he was talking about research into well-documented cases of rainmaking in Kenya and other places in Africa. This was published in the Journal of Modern Anthropology, and he's a research fellow at the Department of Anthropology at Moi University in Kenya. But what was interesting and why Bibu brought this up is because the cases that he cites, and it's going back 100 years in Africa, you know, not just from things that this guy's seen, but other respected anthropologists as well.
You mean like contemporary, like historical reports from the British and that kind of stuff?
Yeah. They've seen the efficacy of these ritual rain dances.
Well, this is something that became quite prominent with the European settlers, you know, here in Australia with the Aboriginal people. They noticed that the Aboriginal people had, you know, certain modalities in dealing with weather, and for whatever reason it worked. It was the same with the Native American people of America.
Yeah.
Like there was, I can't remember the name of which tribe it was, but we covered it on the show where they literally did some type of dance, but it had to be on a particular platform and it had to be done a particular way at a particular time, and it did bring the rains. So it's like there is some like a wide world, you know, cultural understanding that certain practices can manipulate the weather.
And we'll look at the similarity. So one of the first ones he mentions is the Kikuyu people of central Kenya. And there's one of these reports cited. One of the earliest anthropological accounts is from Kenyatta, the first president of post-colonial Kenya. He recounts in vivid details how the Kikuyu community approached their ancestors in prayer, ritual, and sacrifice, beseeching them to intercede with God during times of prolonged drought and failure of rains in due season. So it was like something you did as an emergency.
Right, of course, yeah, yeah.
Hasn't rained in a while, better get the shaman out. During such periods, a team considered pure in heart, mind, and body, who were free from worldly sins, was assembled to offer the sacrifice. Kenyatta acknowledges that rain followed every rain ceremony, and so it's interesting. I read that line of people pure of heart were needed for the sacrifice. I just had to read that and stop and go, well, who's pure of heart?
Children.
That's children, right?
But they're not the sacrifice.
Well,
are they?
I didn't know. I'm like, did Bibu just gloss over this? Were they just sacrificing kids to get some rain? So I looked into some more context of this. So this is Kenyatta, again, the former PM, first PM after they got independence. He wrote a book called Facing Mount Kenya, The Tribal Life of the Kikuyu, that tribe. It was banned in Ireland for some reason. I don't know why. It's like if you go to the Wikipedia, it's all celebrated. Then right at the end, it's like, this book was banned in Ireland.
I wonder why.
I don't know. So it goes through what you have to do, and it's got a big list. And yes, you need a boy and a girl under 8 years old who symbolize innocence. And basically they have to prepare, the elders abstain from sexual intercourse for 6 nights before, sleep separately.
And that's easy if you have kids. Like,
and they actually grab a lamb. So it's a lamb that's sacrificed. And during the sacrifice, the children have to hold it. And it's a sacrifice.
Oh, that's unfair on the kids though.
It's a sacrifice that's done on a sacred tree. And the funny thing about this description and this guy's report, he actually says in the source of the book, if it doesn't work, you try the ritual again until it works.
So what, you just got like lambs and a dispenser ready to go?
So it's like, yeah, he says it works.
You just get every time?
It works every time. But is that like the seventh time you've tried it? It works every time?
Yeah, see, this is a little bit different to some of the other stories. And of course, I mean, they're anecdotal or they're observed, you know, European observers. But, you know, in those cases, it's like rain dance done, the rain comes.
Yeah.
Like not, let's keep on going, let's keep on dancing until it rains 3 weeks later.
Well, the rest of them are more like that. He writes about another dance called the Kilumi, practiced by the Akamba people. During times of drought, again, they do this Kilumi dance where they bring in the prophets or invoke the blessings of water spirits. There's scholars from the mid-80s who wrote about these dances. They poured libations and offerings of sacrifices to appease the spirits. Successful Kilumi dances ended with celebrations as the community expected favorable response of rain from spirits. Both Akonga and Corster, the two anthropologists, said that it never failed to rain after these festivities. 100% of the time it worked. Ombadi also writes about the Nyoro peoples of Uganda. I think I've got a picture of them I can put on the screen. Now, this can be either men or female shaman. They undergo specific training to bring in rain. And during times, again, of serious drought, these guys will be brought in. Ombadi quotes the work of Burahanga, who wrote that in 1982, on the day of the supplication, rainmakers clear a section of the bush or forest used as the shrine for the sacrifice. The shaman provides a minutiae of descriptions of what happens at the shrine. After the ceremony, the people go home to wait for the rain. And according to the anthropologist, they would always get rain before they actually made it home.
So have these practices amongst these cultures, because you're talking about different countries here, and like even before country boundaries, you know, you would have had distance. Have they arisen independently?
Well, obviously they're all culturally connected in a way because they're geographically close.
Mm.
And he's just starting on the African cases. But no, you've got a point though, because the Indonesian shamanistic version of this is very similar. And
yes.
Even when we look at some of the reports from India, they also include sacrifices
yes.
with a sacred tree in a similar way. And the basis of it is, of course, always the same, that you're appealing
Appeasing.
To a spirit. You're appealing to a spirit. Another example he has is from Nigeria, where, again, the priest comes in, the high priest and the people leave food and offerings at the location of their ancestors. Gods answer their prayer, and rain begins to fall immediately. And when there is too much rain, the high priest can also stop it. So again, like the motorcycle race, they can bring her in to stop it. So Bibu says, if all this rainmaking is just backwards thinking, if it's superstition alone, why is it that rain, according to these anthropologists, immediately follows after these rituals and dances? He says, remember, we're not reading the claims of the rainmakers themselves. These are trained professionals doing field reports.
Yep.
Even if there was only one tribe in the world, he said, that was capable of making it rain, it raises a very important question. How is it possible? Are there spirits and deities who control rain? And is it possible for humans to communicate with them? Now, he says, while the African rainmaking rituals invoke the rainmaking spirits and ancestors, and they don't necessarily use some kind of symbolic representation of what that spirit is, he says, in many cultures around the world, the rainmaking spirits, these spirits of water responsible for the floods and for the harvest, they do take on a form. And it's serpents. It's dragons, serpents. They live in the rivers, lakes, and oceans. They possess magical powers to form clouds, whip up violent storms, he says, and bring life-sustaining rain. And that's the Nagas.
That's the Nagas,
we mentioned at the start of the show. So this is where he starts to branch out. And this is really Bibu's strength when he starts to connect all these dots across the world. So he talks about the Pueblo Indians of Southwestern America. So you've got the Hopi, the Zuni, the Tiwa people. The Pueblo Indians, they revere a horned serpent called Avanyu. Lives in the springs, you know, inhabits the oceans, the rivers. It moves in the storm clouds, releases lightning bolts from its mouth, and blesses the people with rain. But when it's displeased, you either get drought or you get floods. Then you've got the Hopi, who still do this dance today, apparently, and I've got this on the screen here. See the guy in the front? He's got a snake in his mouth. They dance around with a snake in their mouth. This is the rain dance or the snake dance. The rain dance is performed in spring during the planting season, and then they do it again at harvest. And the snake dance is in late August. That's the one where they have the snake in their mouth. After the dance, the snakes are released, and they say the snakes going in four directions. They carry the message to the spirits, who then bring the rain.
Mm.
So the snake is like the messenger.
Mm.
And the Hopi are certain, he says, that their rituals and dances help them survive. And he quotes an Indian Country Today newspaper. A Hopi Indian is in the comments section saying, recently during the ski season, the managers of a ski resort in Park City, Utah, invited a group of Uinta dancers to perform a dance that would bring much-needed snow to the resort because there was no snow. There's no snow. You're out of business. You start losing money. They danced, and the next day, she said, it snowed, and it kept snowing for 3 days. Who is to judge the power of prayer or belief? And I love that when money gets involved, all the kind of I guess materialist thinking we have goes out the window, and it's like, okay,
we'll try whatever.
We got to get the rain shaman in. You know, it's like the atheist begging to God to save his life, you know, facing impending doom. All that materialism goes out the window. And then you get to Mesoamerica, so you've got the feathered serpent. So
yes.
We know about Quetzalcoatl with the Aztecs, and you have the Mayans with Kukulkan, essentially the same deity. And of course, you have the pyramid temples that are built that contain the iconography and the depictions of the feathered serpent. So he points out there's a stairway at the pyramid of Kukulcan in Chichen Itza, where the stairway to the top of the pyramid is flanked by the serpents on either side of the stairs, and they terminate in open-mouthed serpent heads at the base, and I've got an image of that.
Yeah, that classic imagery.
There. So, again, it's like the Nagas you were mentioning from India, they're the protectors of the sacred site. Same with the feathered serpent. He's a protector of the sacred site.
Well, I mean, this goes to my point before when I was asking about these particular tribes across Africa, and even though geographically, you know, they are closer, I was wondering if it did arise independently, because clearly you've got what we can see as independent cultures that are geographically dispersed still worshipping the same sort of entity.
Yeah, and it's in those overlaps that it starts to get really interesting and leads to deeper questions. So again, Quetzalcoatl, as we know, he was the bringer of civilization.
Yes.
That bestowed the gifts of knowledge and craft and agriculture and architecture
knowledge.
And writing and everything that would create a civilization, but also the god of wind and rain. He was the bringer of rain clouds, the representation of the celestial water and its associated winds. Even the texts that were translated by the Spanish, like their old codexes, they say Quetzalcoatl, he was the wind, the guide, and the road sweeper in the rain gods. Now, that's an important thing to remember when we get closer to where this is going. The road sweeper of the rain gods, the master of water of those who brought rain. And so what does this all mean? What's it pointing to? Why was Quetzalcoatl called the road sweeper of the rain gods? What role could a serpent possibly have in causing rainfall? And it's a great question. Like, why not a fish god? You know, why not a wave or some kind of, like, there's got to be a better representation of water than a serpent. Why is a serpent related with water?
That's a good question. Is it just the undulating movement or something?
Well, let's look at a couple more examples. So another obvious one.
Oh, the rainbow serpent.
We know this one in Australia. The rainbow serpent is the protector of water bodies and the provider of life-giving rain.
Well, that's because he created them, didn't he? Isn't that this part of the story, that when he moved across the lands that he created the rivers and the valleys?
I don't
like
know.
In the Dreamtime stories?
I just kind of switch off.
Well, these are stories I remember from when I was a kid before it became so politicized here in Australia.
Well, that's why I say I switch off, because they ram it down your throat.
They ram it down. And what's even more absurd is even recently here, there was a guy who built, on his property, built a bridge. Here you go. Yeah, farmer fined $2,000 for disrupting rainbow serpent by building a bridge on his own land. It's absurd.
I like how I can just predict that you're going to mention that story.
It's because, and this is the thing, but there are Aboriginal people that are saying, this is absurd. Like, it's absolutely insane to be doing this to people.
It's because a local tribe said that he disrupted the rainbow spirit's watering hole. And so he had to pay $2,000. And so this is where it crosses over into the political. I've got another example here. So one of our gas giants, Santos, they were in this extended dispute that had to go to the federal court. Because an Aboriginal man said their gas drilling was going to disrupt the rainbow serpent and the crocodile man.
Wasn't that though? But I seem to recall it, like, similar claims was made by some white bitch, and she was like, oh, I'm Aboriginal. And it was like,
well, they're never Aboriginal.
That's the thing. They're hijacking Aboriginal culture.
Yeah, they're always.
But do you see how absurd it is? And see how much money it costs as well? Like, this had to be, I remember this particular dispute. It must have cost, if not tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of dollars to fight in legal costs.
Yeah, and this is constant now, this kind of political hijacking. But the point is that
also
in Australia, the rainbow serpent was the bringer of life. It was connected with water. It was connected with knowledge as well. It's a creating deity. And so then from there, you head to China and you've got the dragon, which is the rain spirit. You've got Yinglong. Horns, spiked crown, sharp fangs, scaly body, poised for action. There's a quote from Han Yu from an 8th century source that says, by puffing out his breath with a roar, the dragon forms the cloud. It is by mounting his own breath that the dragon journeys to all corners of his empyrean. He gives rise to thunder and lightning. He brings about the transformation of nature such that water pours down upon the earth beneath.
Günstig ohne App. Bei Aldi gibt es einen Preis für alle. Diese Woche Bio-Joghurt mit Crispy Müsli, 150 Gramm für nur 89 Cent. Oder Iglo-Rahmspinat, 750 Gramm für nur 1,69 Euro. Entdecke weitere Angebote in deinem Aldi Nord. Aldi. Gutes für alle.
And I read that quote of the dragon's breath being the key to the creation of rain and water. And I recall, I told this story on the show before, I don't know if you remember, but you know the lake out in Canberra, Lake George?
Yes.
Yep. There it is on the screen there.
Very eerie place.
A friend of mine was traveling with a Qigong master who was visiting from China, and they were driving to Canberra because that's our nation's capital.
Well, you basically drive along the, even though it's empty at the moment, well, a lot of the time it's empty, you drive along the banks of it.
Yeah, you drive along this lake, which as you can see on the screen, it mostly always looks like this, where it's just basically looks like desert.
It's farmland.
Or arid farmland. And you'll see cows and sheep going all the way out.
But sometimes it miraculously, and we don't know exactly the mechanics of it, it fills up. And what's strange is there's a lot of paranormal phenomena connected to it, including like it, when it fills up, I think it was only like 4 or 5 feet deep. And a bunch of army cadets drowned in there.
Oh, really?
But there was no, it wasn't like it was bad weather. It was 5 feet deep. And somehow this weird phenomenon occurred.
Well, the geographical explanation is that it's like a big dip.
Yes.
A big collection port, actually.
But what was this visiting Qigong master saying?
Well, as they were driving past, he kind of looked over into the lake with no water in it and told my friend that, oh, the reason the water comes and goes, because this lake is known for overnight just suddenly filling up out of nowhere.
Yeah.
He said the reason behind it filling up and the water disappearing is because there's a dragon there.
Right.
And the dragon, when it breathes out, I can't remember if it was breathe in or breathe out, but when it breathes out, the lake fills with water. So sometimes you'll be driving past and it looks like this.
Mm. Or more.
Well, yeah, it's like completely full right up to the road.
But this is also a lake where there's a lot of strange, when it's full, not when it's empty, when it's full, there's UFO activity associated with
it. Is there?
And there's stories like of people, there was a case from, I think it was the 1970s. I mean, Canberra is bigger now, but even, you know, like 20 years ago, Canberra was about 300,000, maybe 400,000 people. But in the 70s, it was much smaller. And it's also kind of rural. It's like it's in further. And we did a story actually on the weird geomancy of Canberra. But this particular story was that these women were driving along that actual bank, because that's where the highway runs or where the road must have run. I think the highway's been upgraded since. But as they're driving along, some weird UFO popped up out of the water, which again, it's 4 or 5 feet deep. If that, this UFO popped up out of the water and locked some type of tractor beam onto their car and started dragging them towards the water. And I think enough screaming and carrying on, it all stopped and then it disappeared. But like, what an incredible story from this, you know, body of water that has this paranormal history attached to it.
Even if you do a bit of searching on Lake George, just on the general way it fills up with water, it sounds mysterious in itself.
Yeah.
Like they say, it's extremely unpredictable. The waters come and go like a mirage. There are stories of the lake's waters retreating up to a kilometer from the shore in the course of a single night.
Yep.
It just vanishes.
Just vanish.
And there's been all these theories that there's underground caverns and all sorts of stuff underneath
there. Yeah, there's springs there and yeah. None of which has been validated though.
Yeah, of course. So anyway, you know, going back to China, there's a few sources, Bibu sites, where, again, it's a ritual. It's an appeasement to this serpent-like deity to bring water. So there's an account that at the time of drought in Kaiyuan, this is back in the, 713 CE, we hear of an official who had a single white dragon painted on the walls of his office. Immediately, a dragon rose from the lake and mounted the clouds and winds, and the rain duly followed. So the idea is that it's some kind of magical painting. It's like summoning the spirit.
But it's almost like a talisman.
Yeah, something like that. A popular technique was to fashion clay dragons and perform the Steps of Yu, which was a dance at the side of a steep pool to induce the dragon to come out of its lair. Dancing Yus would perform with scarlet drums, and after prayers they give thanks and, again, sacrifice animals. So there's sacrifice involved as well. Then we head to ancient India. So the symbolism of the serpent is the Naga, but you also have the water dragon in India, which is the Makara. Bibu points out both very popular with water and rain. So the Nagas are throughout Asia, and semi-divine serpents live in deep lakes, rivers, you know the drill, but also protect treasure, protect ancient sites, protect sacred spaces. Here's an example of one from Angkor Wat on the left there.
I've seen this.
Across India, it is not unusual to see stone-carved Naga idols placed under a sacred tree. So again, this connection to the tree, the same as Africa. Villagers make offerings to the Naga gods to ensure rain, fertility, and protection. On a specific day of the year called Naga Panchami, villagers make offerings to the Nagas for adequate rainfall and bountiful harvests. And there it is. So isn't that weird? It's the same as the African thing where you do the ritual under the tree. You give offerings under the sacred tree.
That's the strange thing about it. It's like it's at some point, these different cultures have recognized that the entity that's responsible for it is very similar.
Okay, but here's where it gets really strange. There's another entity you've got to deal with when you're looking at India and also Southeast Asia as well, and that's the Makara, or the water dragon. It's directly tied to rainfall, and the Makara is like a weird hybrid, and it's got an elephant snout, crocodile's body, a lion's paw, and a peacock's tail.
So it's a chimera.
Yeah, it's a chimera. That's what it looks like. So that's one from a museum in Calcutta. See, can you kind of make it out?
Kind of, yeah.
See, there's a dude sitting on the back. So the Makara is sometimes shown with someone on its back, and that's Varuna, the Vedic god in charge of waters, oceans, and rain. So everything about this is rain, harvest,
water thing.
Water. So here's another one from an Indian temple on the screen there.
An elephant? Oh, but because you said it's got, it's crocodile body, elephant nose.
It's got that kind of elephant trunk. Here's a more modern version, again, from India.
How cool is that?
But these are found all over Asia. So you also find them in China.
Thailand?
You also find them, they're in Thailand. They're in the Mayan and Olmec cultures have them as well.
So the Olmecs had them.
Yeah, so this is where it gets super weird. So here's an example. You've got on the top image there, that's an Olmec dragon.
A greenstone figure of a dragon, 900 to 300 BCE.
And then you've got...
Oh, it's for sale.
You've got the
Mayan... You can control the weather.
You've got the Mayan god of rain. That's in the bottom right. And let me zoom in a little bit. Can you see its face?
Yeah.
It's got the elephant snout. And then you got this one from China, the Makara head in Beijing, the same thing. And then you've got the one I showed you earlier from India. How do they all have the same weird chimera hybrid creature?
The only thing that could come
to mind. It's all responsible for rain in every culture.
Yeah. The only thing that could come to mind is that this is from an unrecognized greater global culture that has existed prior to all these civilizations, and it somehow has spread into them later on.
Well, the Mayans, that's a good point, because the Mayans followed the Olmecs.
Correct.
And we know that it's likely that the Olmecs were Chinese refugees who fled a crumbling kingdom in what was it, like 1500 BC or something?
Mm.
And they made it to the coast of Mexico.
So it's like there is a progenitor. And leave somewhere.
That's a whole other rabbit hole. And let me give you
That's for Graham Hancock. We won't go
Let
there.
Me give you a little test. Which one of these is Olmec and which one of these is Xiong Chinese?
That's Olmec. That's Xiong.
This one's Xiong?
That's Xiong.
And this one's Olmec.
That's Olmec.
Because you know. You're correct.
What?
This one, which looks like the carving of a Chinese guy's face.
Why do you say that, Ben?
Is Olmec.
Right.
This one, which looks like an alien, is Chinese. That's Xiong Chinese. Isn't that weird, though? I mean, that one just looks Olmec, but it's Xiong Chinese.
Do you think so? I don't necessarily think so. I think there's more. What it gave it away for me is what was the material?
Jade, because they both use jade. They both heavily use jade. This is another one. So you see the ritual Kong on the left, which is Xiong Dynasty, and then you've got the motif on the right, which is Olmec. It's the same guy. It's the same dude. Just slightly different style.
So what this is suggesting is, one, is that, you've got shamans from these groups that are interfacing with this other realm, and they're seeing these things. They're actually seeing these entities, which is possible, which is, plausible. It's superstitious, but it's plausible. Or there is a progenitor contact some here or culture.
I think in the case of the Mesoamerica and the Chinese connection, it's pretty undeniable, especially when you look at their text. Like on the left, you've got the Olmec script. And on the right, you've got Shang Dynasty Chinese script.
I mean, yeah.
It's the same.
It's the same.
It's the same. And remember, we covered this on a show. I think it was, where was it? It was actually from one of Bibu's articles. From where did the Olmecs learn yoga, the evidence of trans-Pacific contact? And we ended up doing a show on this. I'll link to that in the show notes as well. But he had the story of the, remember it was like a guy who studied, it was a Chinese scholar, and he studied Shang script. And he went into like an Olmec museum display one day and randomly he was like, oh, I can read that.
Yeah.
That's weird. I understand what this writing is. And that's how he made the connection.
And ultimately, it's all originating from High German.
That's right. It all traces back to High German. Well said. We can mention that on our new podcast, In Uniform. So incidentally, he says many temples in India and Southeast Asia have a Makara balustrade where the serpentine body of the Makara forms the handrail of the staircase and it terminates in that Makara head. So let me zoom in and get a bit on Indonesia.
Mm.
So you got the same creature terminating on the head there of the serpent. And that's the one from Mexico. Now, from here, it gets even stranger.
Are these Bibu's own photos?
Yeah, a lot of these is from his travels around the world.
That's so cool.
So let's talk about the Naga King. In a lot of these statues of the Makara, this weird hybrid creature with the elephant's nose and all the other bits, there's a Naga King emerging from the mouth of the Makara or the dragon or the serpent. Let me give you...
Was that image you put up before of like the peacock kind of thing?
Well, this is an example here. So we can see the Makara creature, see his head, and see how coming out of his mouth, there's this like little monkey dude. See this guy coming out of his mouth?
Where? Oh, I see. Right. Yeah, it's right in front of me. Wow.
So...
Yeah, that's amazing.
In some sculptures of India and Southeast Asia, the serpent king, the Naga Raja, is shown emerging from the mouth of the Makara, of this serpent dragon. He's depicted in the form of a lion-faced animal wearing a many-hooded serpent crown. So the one I'm showing on the screen right here is from Cambodia. So in those balustrades flanking the stairways of temples in Southeast Asia, it's the same as Mesoamerica. You will often see this this serpent coming out of the Makara.
I've been here.
So this one's Thailand.
I've been here.
That's
I've
why
seen
you
this.
Asked,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
Do you know where this is in Thailand?
Yeah,
I didn't write it down.
There is
anyway.
It's somewhere where a ship pulls up because I went in on a ship.
Okay.
So it's not far from a ship.
So this is, I wish I was showing my cursor because I can't really show you, but you can see the Makara on the back there. Kind of mauve-looking creature. And the Naga King is coming out of his mouth. See all the serpents coming out of the mouth?
Mm.
What is going on?
It may not be the same location because the one I went with had like a big Buddha lounging inside, but there was something very similar to this hanging around outside.
But okay, so this is in Thailand.
Yeah.
And we've seen it in Cambodia, but that's all Southeast Asia. But the weird thing is, like, you go to Mexico... It's coming out of the thing's head in Mexico as well. Like, see the jaws of the creature there?
Mm.
And there's the little dude's head coming out of it. It's the same thing. This is in Labna in the Yucatan Peninsula of Mexico. Archaeologists have found the carving attached to the roof of one of the buildings. And the Mesoamerican archaeologists, he says, have no clue what this represents. Absolutely no idea.
So there's no, like... I guess because there's not really any, there wouldn't be written text or anything left, would there? It's only coming from carvings.
Because everyone's so specialized, you don't have too many people making these cross-cultural connections. Because all this trans-Pacific contact and these ancient people influencing each other to this massive degree isn't something that's really acknowledged in mainstream archaeology.
Nor do they want to acknowledge it by the sounds of it.
Well, exactly, because then it puts a question on the true origins of the cultural things that they prize so highly. Mm. But this is a clear example of this symbology being shared or maybe, like you mentioned, some dominant ancient, super ancient civilization that influenced... All the entire world existed in the past but has now been lost.
Well, I don't want to say Atlantis, but something like that, like a civilization that has been lost.
Something like that idea. And Bibu notes that this is obvious. There is obviously massive trans-Pacific contact. There's exchange of ideas, cultural ideas. But what does it all mean? Well, he says what is even more critical to determine is what do these complex symbols and beliefs about the dragon and serpent spirits actually refer to? He says most scholars happily dismiss them as myth-making. It's just all these different cultures making up images, symbology, metaphors.
I'm sorry, it can't be that much of a coincidence.
Well, that's what he says. It doesn't make any sense at all that it would be that. Why would so many widely dispersed cultures evolve a complex set of beliefs and symbols that are similar? And it's not only across geography, it's similar across time as well, because we're talking about very old civilizations, you know, going up to, you know, relatively modern times.
Well, the thing is, from like the representation of a chimeric being, I could understand why a culture would create a being which would be similar to another culture, because you would like a trunk, well, that's the nose, and then the face is a crocodile, and like that all kind of makes sense, right? It's just a natural thing that human beings would do by looking at different creatures and going, oh, that kind of matches up with that. But when you have something so specific of it emerging from the mouth of another end, it's like,
yeah, why would they all have some snake king coming out of its mouth? Like, they all happen to randomly have the same, what's that word? What's that game when you would join pictures together?
Oh.
What's that game? You draw something and then you fold it down and it joins it together. I can't remember.
No, I can't remember, no.
One of those weird things.
Yeah, I get it though.
With a million possible combinations. Yeah, they come up with the same combination.
Thing. Each culture.
And the weird dude coming out of its mouth. He says it's all a big mystery. Dragons come out of water bodies. They create rain clouds. Serpents emerge from the mouth of the dragon. They bring wind, rain, and lightning. These rain spirits are conscious and they can be invoked through rituals. What are these images referring to? What are the ancients trying to convey? Now, Bibu admits he had seen all these connections a long time ago and pondered it for many years and came up with nothing. He just could not solve the mystery of why there were these connections. Until,
well, if Bibu can't do it, then stuff it. Show's done.
Until now, he says.
Oh, okay. All right.
He started reading about the phenomenon of atmospheric rivers and it all started to click. So what is an atmospheric river? So these are massive rivers of moisture in the atmosphere that carry more water than 15 Mississippi rivers combined.
Wow.
They're long, narrow corridors of intense water vapor transport that can be thousands of kilometers long, sometimes spanning entire oceans. Here's an example from satellite imagery there. You can see it stretching across from, where's that, from Asia to the coast of America.
So with my lack of meteorological knowledge, isn't that just cloud cover? Is it, obviously, it's cloud cover, but it's full of precipitation.
Well, this is just a term. It was coined by meteorologists Reginald Newell and Yong Ju. They're both from MIT, and they coined this term in 1998. They found that although there are only 3 to 5 atmospheric rivers in the mid-latitudes of each hemisphere at any given time, they carry more than 90% of the total moisture moving poleward.
Oh, so this is what ties in with like El Nino and La Nina.
Yeah, I guess that's all connected.
Yeah.
Think of these guys as they're literally just, the name's great. They're just rivers in the atmosphere. And since they carry so much water vapor, once they cross land, they can trigger torrential rainfall, dangerous mudslides, heavy snow, floods as well. Now, if you're in a region that doesn't have any of these atmospheric rivers, what do you get?
Arid, desert-like landscapes.
You get the opposite. You get droughts. I found a video from Michigan Engineering today on YouTube, and I hope I can play a clip without getting banned, but let's roll the dice. Let's take a listen.
Atmospheric rivers are global scale moisture transport systems that drive the majority of moisture redistribution from the tropics to higher latitudes. These systems of transport are highly important in connection with the replenishment of water resources in many areas around the world. However, they are also influenced by climate change. Extreme weather events such as severe flooding and high winds are now found to be associated with atmospheric rivers. Postdoctoral fellow Ashley Payne has developed a series of animations that have enabled her to understand what creates an intense atmospheric river before its impact, with the goal of better representing them in climate models so that water resource managers can be better prepared for these events.
They're such fluid features, and that's what made studying them so difficult to start with. How do you pin down the climatological behavior of something that's constantly moving around? You know, no one had really tried to look at the large-scale features of these atmospheric rivers before. By looking at
the reason I wanted to play that clip is because it demonstrates how new this science is in terms of fully understanding how these atmospheric effects work.
Well, the moment they say models, I'm just like, throw it out.
Really?
Throw it out. Don't trust it for a second.
But there's a bunch of studies from the early 2000s that show these atmospheric rivers were directly responsible for like huge floods in California. There's one linking droughts to South Africa and Spain. Like, they are crucial to these major weather events throughout the world. And Bibu goes through some of the scientific literature on these and says, look, there's been a bunch of names assigned to these over the years. Like, tropical plumes is one. Moisture filaments is another. Atmospheric conveyor belts. But he says they've missed an obvious name. And the obvious name is they're rain serpents.
Yeah.
The way they look, rivers. The way they behave, yeah. The way they function in the atmosphere is exactly like a serpent. He says structurally and functionally, they were identical. Atmospheric rivers look like long serpents. They do what serpents are supposed to do. They bring rain. Moreover, he says atmospheric rivers are also associated with, like I said, disastrous floods, droughts, something that the ancients feared that the serpent would bring upon them if it was provoked or if it didn't get enough sacrifice. So apparently, again, this is all new science from like NASA satellites.
Catching up with ancient philosophy.
Exactly, like the latest data imaging software, essentially showing something that the ancients had a sophisticated understanding of.
Well, the only difference is, though, is that surely with the ancients, doesn't it suggest that there is a belief that they can summon them?
Like, yeah, so I'll get to that. So okay. There's a clear distinction between the modern scientific view and what the ancients understood. And we'll get into that because that's important. But I just wanted to show you another image. I haven't included it. Why didn't I include it? I'm just have to quickly put this up on my screen, because there's an image he saw from NASA, which really showed the connection. Here it is here. Let me just pop it up in my browser. I'll just put it on the screen there. So he saw this. This is rivers in the sky, and it's a depiction from NASA and the NOAA. He says it shows an atmospheric river making landfall on the west coast of the United States. The serpentine plume of moisture is pushed up the coastal range, moves down into the valley, and is again directed up the Sierra Nevada mountain range. And as the vapors rise over the mountains, they condense and fall as heavy snow, hail, or freezing rain. So look at how it's kind of going up over the range, then it's dipping down again, and it's going back over the Sierra Nevada and then back down again. Now compare that modern NASA image with this.
Mm.
That's a depiction of the feathered serpent in central Mexico. What's it doing?
Well, it's dipping down and then going back up.
It's coming up.
And then spewing out.
It's going over the mountain range. It's dipping up, going over the next mountain range. And then it's spewing out the rain out of its mouth.
Mm.
And so this is the water deity. Did they really understand this to that degree of accuracy 1,300 years ago?
Yeah, I think they must have. Or at least they may have. And
wow, we're only discovering this now with satellites.
Because it's like we hear stories about shaman about how did you work out ayahuasca with all the thousands of species that you somehow worked out the exact two plants in a rainforest that grants you like the right chemical combination to access ayahuasca. Like what are the odds? And of course, when shamans are asked, how did that happen? They're like, well, the plants told us.
Yeah, they spoke to the spirits. Like if the spirits directed
the spirits.
Them.
So if they're using shamanism for this, the spirits told them.
Exactly. And so the next question this led Bibu to was, where's the Makara? Where's the water dragon? Because we know in these depictions, these ancient depictions, you've got the serpent, but there's the Naga King coming out of its mouth, these multi-plumed serpents. So what does that refer to? He said, scientists tell us that atmospheric rivers originate from gigantic masses of water vapor that form over the oceans. He said, I couldn't really get any more details, So he decided to look at the next best thing, which is how thunderstorms form over land. And so he goes into cumulonimbus clouds and Arcus clouds.
Oh, they're the big fluffy ones, aren't they?
Yeah, the big super fluffy ones and how they form. I'll put one on the screen there. Why not? And it's not the way you would think. Like, he says that many of us might think that over the day, water evaporates and it gradually forms into clouds.
You know, I've never really thought about it, but that makes sense. That's the way you would think it would work.
He says that's nonsense. It doesn't actually happen like that. Like, any water that's evaporated out of the air just kind of returns to the ground by the end of the day anyway.
Now I think of it, I was always told that for whatever reason, it evaporates from the ocean and then moves in from the ocean, which would be consistent with this.
He says nearly all the water that evaporates from the oceans and rivers during the day condenses soon afterwards and just falls back into the reservoirs. What happens during a thunderstorm is something abrupt, something really quick and chaotic. He says all of a sudden a very powerful updraft is initiated over a large body of water that sucks up warm, moisture-laden air, forms a dense towering cloud. That's the one I've got on the screen, the cumulonimbus.
Yeah, isn't it the higher they go, the more it indicates you're going to have a heavier storm?
Yeah, and sometimes they're so strong they suck up fish, so that's why you have the fish rains.
Right.
And within a span of just 5 to 45 minutes, one of these clouds is this towering monster, like several kilometers across, 69,000 feet in height. And then this is what creates rain. It comes from this process, and they have a very distinct shape. Now, if you look at the towering mass of cloud, you've got the striations, you've got this anvil shape. The top looks very similar to the striated tail of a water dragon.
You can see the water falling in that one too.
So compare the kind of top and the sides of that to something like this carving here.
Yeah, it looks the same, doesn't it? There's like a plumage.
It's almost like they're depicting clouds.
Mm.
That's what Bibu's thinking anyway. What do you think?
I agree.
Like, you compare carving to these depictions.
Look, it's easy enough to kind of look at things and go, oh, well, I can see a similarity. But with the research he's presented, it's very plausible.
He says another intriguing phenomenon happens as one of those cumulonimbus clouds begins to move. At the leading edge of one of these clouds is a gust front. It's like a wedge-shaped cloud at the front. I think I've got a diagram of it. See down the bottom, you've got a shelf cloud.
Mm-hmm.
It's like down in the bottom right, it says shelf cloud. That's the direction. Well, that's kind of at the front, but it's going in the other direction. They call that the Arcus cloud, the shelf cloud. It's always at the front of the storm. It's like the warning of the storm. And it emerges from the base of the cumulonimbus cloud and remains connected. But it acts as like almost like a sweeping thing at the front, like it sweeps the atmosphere preparing for the storm. And
like,
remember, that was the description of Quetzalcoatl.
Yes.
He was the sweeper,
sweeping
the storm
away.
Sweeper.
Yeah.
Right? And he provides, Bibu has a few images, examples of these Arcus clouds. Let's have a look here.
Look at that. That's
so
really cool.
What does that look like to you? Does that look like a serpent coming in? Or a plume of serpents across the sky?
Yeah. Jeez, that's an amazing photo.
He says, from my perspective, the
is
shelf cloud...
look.
Yeah, yeah. He says the shelf... or maybe it's a render.
Last one looks AI, yeah.
He says it looks like an array of gigantic, ominous sky serpents arranged in layers, one above the other, swooping down upon the landscape. It sucks the warm air upwards so that the cold front or gust front can move forward. Exactly the description of Quetzalcoatl. He was the bringer of the rain clouds, the guide and road sweeper of the rain gods. And remember, you go to Thailand.
Yep.
It's showing these multiple layers of this naga coming out of the mouth of the main storm.
Now I want to find it. Because
you want to find the temple.
Yeah, it's the same thing. It was definitely in Thailand, though. But how extraordinary that you have these cultures like that are using, it's like, it is an animism to describe something to us, like, because we don't have this superstition. We don't, even the kids look at the clouds, right? And of course they imagine what they look like, but these cultures around the world are depicting it in their, like, their hardcore beliefs.
Well, sometimes at the front of those systems, you have an Arcus cloud, but it's of a different type. They call it a roll cloud. And this one looks even more like a serpent. Look at this one.
Yeah.
Look at that.
Yeah.
Looks like a giant snake across the sky.
Yeah, it does.
They're rarer, but you do get them as well. So he says, on the whole, I believe there's enough evidence to infer that the symbolism of the Naga emerging from the mouth of the Makara represents the Arcus clouds emerging from the cumulonimbus cloud at its leading edge. It's moving the storm front forward. He said it encapsulates the ancient understanding of how rainfall occurs, and it is in perfect sync with what we are now finding out. So this then leads to the bigger question, and I inferred earlier with the question of, well, how did the ancients know? And I think quite correctly you point out, why are you looking? He's looking for this Thai temple.
I found it. Just have a look at it. Like, it's the same thing. Like, it's a little bit different. But like, oh, it's pretty.
Oh, yeah, it's the same thing.
Like, isn't that just incredible?
Okay, so did the ancient people, so you might be of the Von Daniken persuasion. You might like the Ancient Aliens program, and you might think, okay, so the ancient people actually did have satellites, and they actually did have this super technology that could scan this in the way that we can today.
I don't go down that path.
Some people might think that.
Yeah, sure. I get that. And that falls into, you know, I referenced Atlantis before, but the idea was, whether it was Atlantis or not, it was a culture that was highly advanced technologically and that much, much, much older than we could ever possibly imagine, setting back human history far further than what, you know, modern day anthropology and archaeology tells us. However, I'm not so sure that that's the case. I think what a lot of this stuff is, they're literally just talking to spirits.
Exactly. And as I was reading through this, I was worried. I was like, Bibu, are you just giving a material explanation for the ancients? Like, yeah, they just understood this stuff. And they used iconography to explain weather. Is that really what they believed? Because it's not how they behaved.
I don't think Bibu would suggest that.
They gave sacrifice to these entities.
Yeah.
No one's sacrificing to the Weather Channel. Like, no one's sacrificing because they think that, you know, the clouds form a particular shape. They're sacrificing because they believe that they believe that an entity can control it.
Entire nations, including Australia, are sacrificing themselves to the horror that is net zero. In a belief system that by us going to net zero is going to stop climate change. Do you see what, from a modern perspective, what's happening? There's a belief system and people are offering a sacrifice.
Yeah, that's an interesting analogy, actually. Yeah.
It's a cult.
Sacrificing human beings.
We are sacrificing human beings for Gaia.
It's more for Gaia.
Yeah, but it's like, but look at it. Same it's for idea. Weather. Climate. It's weather. And it changes. And there's a whole heap of other factors that come in. Oh, I won't go there today. But it's like, see what happens? It's like it's become a belief system. So to say that there's an ancient culture that is sacrificing, I see where you're going, right? Like, it's still, I think they're talking to spirits. But there is a plausibility that it's like if you have enough belief, you sacrifice something to the weather channel.
Well, the reason I wanted to bring the discussion in that direction is because, you know, when you see something like this, yes, it shows an understanding of the way, the mechanism behind the way the weather functions on our planet. And it's an incredible understanding because it requires such a zoomed out view of the Earth. It requires seeing things on a massive macro scale over time across vast regions. They understood that. They understood very particular structures about it. But I don't think they understood that because they were looking at the material processes of our world.
No.
I think they understood that because there is a spirit controlling it. There is a spirit of the rain and of the weather. And the ancient people had a particular way to converse and commune with these entities.
And you can't go, oh, no. They're just, you know, they're a superstitious culture. I'm like, okay. They very well may have been. But if they're a superstitious culture, why don't you have this culture in this part of the world going, oh, it's a gorilla being that pulls up clumps of dirt and throws it into the sky. And then you've got this other culture going, oh, it's a bunch of rhesus monkeys that mate in this certain way.
Yeah,
You know, it's like, no. All these distinct cultures are describing the same imagery down to the chimeric makeup of what it is, and then how it's so consistent with our, even though it's like an animism of an actual you know, system that we recognize scientifically, but it's like they got that. So you can't just be like, no, they're superstitious. They were superstitious, but superstitious enough that they appear to have been talking to accurate sources.
I don't even think they necessarily understand the mechanisms that we do today. Because
yes.
It's more that they observe the spirit. They yes. have a communication, a sort of understanding of the spirit world that we don't have.
But not just that, you throw in the sacrifice.
Well, I'll mention more on that in a moment. But there's a particular part of this. Bibbu adds another thing to consider. He says these cumulonimbus clouds, they're known to generate powerful asymmetric electromagnetic fields.
Sure.
He says this makes it very likely that even the Arcus clouds and the atmospheric rivers are structured by powerful electromagnetic fields. Well, why is this important? He says a number of consciousness studies indicate that electromagnetic fields are related to consciousness, since both the human brain and the heart are powerful generators of EM fields. And he references a paper that was published by Rupert Sheldrake. It's called "Is the Sun Conscious?" Mm. Remember this one?
I do recall this, yeah.
It cited the work of many authors. There was John Joe McFadden, who believes that the brain's EM field is in fact the physical substrate of consciousness. And conscious volition results from the influence of the brain's EM field on neurons that initiate motor actions. So it's almost like one way you could look at it is the materialist representation of the literal mind of the spirit is what is displayed as our weather.
Yes.
So the spirit wants to go this way and do this and do that. Well, we see it in our skies as an atmospheric river, as this electromagnetic field. It's literally a reflection of the spirit's mind. So by communing directly with the spirit, that's how the ancients understood the mechanisms. We just look at the mechanisms. We don't look at what's behind it. Now, we have this intricate understanding of the, you know, the fine details of the mechanism.
But this is the
issue. But we're missing what's
yes.
the mind that's behind the mechanism.
Yep. And because we're so enthralled by materialism that we're actually blinded to anything that could be outside of that very narrow framework. It's like looking at the electromagnetic spectrum. It's like visible light exists in a very, very small part of that. And that's everything that we see. But the reality is it's much, much, much wider. And there's so much more to it that we just simply can't physically, we can measure it with our instruments, right? But those instruments have been created by our thinking, like the way that our,
right,
the structure of our thinking.
We can't penetrate the other world.
Correct. Whereas these cultures, for whatever reason, the direction that they went in, maybe because the difference was a lack of technology, it allowed them to be able to access this spiritual realm.
Well, it seems like just a different technology.
Perhaps, but maybe it's a spirit, maybe it's spiritual technology in itself. Like maybe that is the technology. But I feel like it's this, I was only watching it today, actually. It's funny you should mention Sheldrake, because I'm going to cover, Sheldrake's got a new paper out where he's talking about the end of life experiences and near death experiences of animals, right? Which is like animals, like, but it's quite fascinating where many of the near death and like end of life experiences that we've spoken about on the show, like hospice workers and nurses and those sorts of things, like terminal lucidity and that sort of stuff, it's all happens with animals as well.
Really?
Like pet owners describing, there was this one of woman saying that they had this cat and the cat came in. And there was four members of the family, and the cat spent 15 minutes on each member, on each lap of a member of the family, then kind of looked up as if saying goodbye and just wandered out into the wilderness. Mm. And then they found it dead. It was like this. And Sheldrake looked into this and he's like, there are case after case after case of this strange effect, but terminal lucidity in dogs that have cancer and they're on their way out. And then right at the final moment before they've like, and they've been, almost at the point of being unable to walk, they're bouncing about and they're ready to, you know, play and they lick their owners and then they toddle off and pass away. It's this really weird effect, which is repeated in animals as in humans.
That's wild.
Yeah. So, I mean, that's a side thing, which is just fascinating. You mentioned Sheldrake, but this idea though, of like Sheldrake is a really great example of someone who is, you know, very much within this framework of materialism because of, you know, where he's, the institutions he works with, but is willing to go outside those boundaries to go, well, hang on, there is empirical evidence that there is something going on here. We don't, that evidence, which is essentially data, is not giving us information, but it does allow us to ponder what's going on. And that's almost what's occurring here is that, like, these cultures, because they weren't defined by this technological belief, they would contact the spirits. And it's almost like our culture, as we've been cut off from spiritualism, we have a lot, and there's an arrogance to it, right? We have this arrogance, oh, we're not superstitious.
We're not backwards.
We're not backwards. We're not some backwards culture. And, you know, but it's like, they understood this stuff. And it's taken us millennia to work. It's only now where we can look back and go, they understood it 2,000 years ago.
It's an interesting question to ask of whether the people that built that even understand it. Because what you end up seeing is just the cultural relics that are passed down. So hundreds, even 1,000 years after this knowledge is, I guess, discovered and solidified, this just becomes tradition.
Yes.
So do the people that, you know, carve this on a temple in Thailand have any understanding of what this represents?
Potentially not.
Maybe not.
No. Yeah.
Right. And that's why when you have the modern stories, like, I'm not allowed to build a bridge over my local creek because the Aboriginal council will fine me. You know, that's why that stuff ends up being just divisive nonsense.
But it's not. It's because it's the problem is, though, in my opinion, it's not about belief. It's about money.
It's all political. Yeah.
Yeah. It's all about politics and money.
Well, in the end, Bibu was in agreement. He said we could argue that the powerful rain and storm-generating clouds like the cumulonimbus clouds, Arcus clouds, and atmospheric rivers are inhabited by conscious spirits who orchestrate the whole process and provide the requisite energy and intelligence. And he adds at the end, we're kind of at this stage with civilization where we have to let go of the purely materialistic worldview.
We won't.
Don't abandon it completely. Because,
of course not.
You know, for example, like, we're talking about in Kenya, they're doing studies on rain dances. Kenyans don't have clean water.
Yeah.
It's like they don't have drinking water for most of the population.
That's part of where the arrogance does come through, though, because don't get me wrong, materialism has done wonderful things. Like, only recently I've been reading, what is it, The Dirt on Clean. And it's like this whole idea about how we basically, with sanitation and how we've created, but what it's taken us to get here, right? So we can look back and go, well, now we don't sacrifice a goat to, you know, get our crops to grow. Mm. Like, we understand that fertilizers work and that kind of stuff. Yeah, it's had its benefits, but the point I'm trying to make is that if we go too far with it and get so caught up in that arrogance and in that belief, materialism in itself becomes a belief, we cut ourselves off from other possibilities.
Yeah, I think you're right. Bibu is saying that there's an opportunity to recognize there are other dimensions of existence. There are intelligences that are behind how our world works.
When it comes to climate change, for an example, like, one of the arguments that's put forward by alternative researchers is that it's to do with the electromagnetic. It's funny that you should again mention is the sun conscious. It's the electromagnetic effects of the sun. And it's on certain cycles, and those cycles are much longer than we have scientifically recognized. And that's what influences our weather systems and our climate patterns. And it's like, well, if we understand that there is some consciousness or there is some, it's not doing appeasing, but if we could understand it from a more, I guess, perhaps a cult perspective, a spiritual perspective, could we reverse some of these uncomfortable climate events that are taking place? Or could we prevent them from happening in the first place? But we would never do that because that's not scientific. That's not within the paradigm of what our funding allows us to investigate. Mm.
I think a good traditional understanding is that the moral nature and the virtue of a civilization is really, and its people, is really what decides how nature treats them, how nature
Correct.
Treats human
Yes.
beings, how these entities treat human beings. It's like the traditional view is that if the population is not virtuous, you know,
you get flooded out.
It's like the biblical stories. You'll
Yes.
be punished by floods and Yep. disasters. It's like the best way to appease the gods is to be righteous, not to be
debaucherous dancing.
Yeah. Not to be the opposite. Not to sacrifice people.
Which is what we're doing now.
Not to sacrifice human beings.
We're sacrificing entire nations to this cult. And that's what's going on. And I think these entities, if they do exist, and suggest from what we've been talking about that they do, we're pissing them off.
Well, that brings a whole other perspective when you look at how others have viewed this topic. This is a new book from Eric Nansteel. Do you remember this guy?
No, I don't, but remind
me. Does the
me.
Artwork look familiar? Remember the guy with the pyramid cone over his genitals?
Oh, I do remember this.
Angst in the Shadows.
Yes.
We covered this weeks
that was
ago.
Like pyramid fleshlight.
He followed up with a book called The Blood Covenant. So he looks at all these same connections, and it's a very large book, actually. It's like 440 pages.
To what, between pyramids and fleshlights?
No, he goes through those same connections between cultures of worshipping the gods of nature. So the spirits that control the weather.
Oh, ancient sacrifices, cattle mutilations and alien abductions are not separate mysteries. They are phases of the same contact, one in which human life is harvested as a resource and genetic stock.
So okay. He looks at all those same similarities across cultures, but then starts to question, well, why do all these gods and these ancient deities require blood?
Well, that comes back to the thesis I have, that blood is like this life force, and it's not. But when you think about it, blood is a life force, right? Mm. But it's not just the fact that it's moving oxygen and gases around your blood and everything else. It's that there's something spiritual to blood, which is why, like only recently I referenced, we have stories of UFOs chasing bloodmobiles.
Mm.
You know, or blood being used by like certain sacrificial rituals in, where was it, in Costa Rica to summon deities and entities.
It's got a foreword by Linda Moulton Wow.
Oh, there you go.
So could be worth looking into. I'll tell you a little bit about it after the break, actually, because I have read a little bit of it.
Yeah, okay, let's go into
that. He has a completely different view to Bibu. But in the meantime, mysteriousuniverse.org. Check out the article, I'll link to it in the show notes, The Dragon and Serpent Rain Spirits and the Enigmatic Makara Naga Symbolism. And while you're there, go to Listen Subscriptions or mysteriousuniverse.org/plus. Sign up to our membership. Prices start from $5 a month. And you can also get our MU Max plan, which gives you access to our entire back catalogue, going back nearly 20 years worth of podcasts. And of course, when the new show that Aaron and I goes live, which we're hoping will be January, maybe February.
Probably February. I need a break.
We'll see. I'll try and convince him to come back in January because he just needs like a week off.
Just a week. Yeah, that's fine.
And when we do that new show, if you're on Plus, you will get access to Mysterious Universe, obviously, and all the membership there, but you'll also get access to our new show. So if you sign up and retain your membership, you'll be getting two podcasts for the price of one. So we think that's a good deal. You get the new show.
Initially.
Domestic terrorism with the boys?
You know what? It's not going to happen because you're going to have your door kicked in by the Queensland police before you know it. And I'll be like, I told him. I'd be the one to tip them off. But still.
I've got a dead man's drop ready to trigger that basically implicates you in everything. It sets you up as the mastermind.
Yeah.
Behind.
I've got it set that our Telegram chats get deleted straight away the moment that happens.
All my comments in private chats, it just changes to your name.
Yeah. 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 And all the other groups you're associated with, I'm sure that will go down really nicely.
Mysteriousuniverse.org/plus. Sign up today. Help support your favorite show. That's a wrap for this free edition of the podcast. Thanks for listening. Thanks for watching. If you're on Plus, stick around for the great stuff after the break. For everyone else, we'll catch you next week. Welcome back to your Plus Extension. Great to have you with us.